I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. Title for today, 12 Differentiating Strategies for Creating More Value for Your Customers. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services and will be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items and we'll jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time, Lighthouse provides in-depth work style and personality assessments for both new hire candidates and for staff development. We also offer a number of workshop topics to associations and trade organizations. If you'd like more information, please email me as indicated on your screen. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to a number of calls we've been getting from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that most organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guest. You'll also want to have some paper and a pen handy to take notes, since we'll be sharing many ideas that you'll want to consider and implement with your team and discuss with your trusted advisors. Our special guest with us today is Mark Emmer, who is a longtime friend and business colleague. Many of you know Mark from his best-selling book, Intended Consequences. And if you haven't read it, the information for getting it copy is on your screen. Personally, I would highly recommend getting it if you don't have it. It was so intriguing. I read it in one reading because it just engaged me. And so literally Intended Consequences for what we're going to do with our businesses. Mark is the president of Optimize, Inc., a California-based management consulting firm, and is sought after by CEOs as an expert in strategic planning and profit improvement. His content has been covered in Forbes, Fox Business, and CNBC. I feel privileged to have Mark with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin right after we conclude this program. The topic will be working with your team going into 2012. Are they ready? Big question. Mark, I want to welcome you. Thanks for being on Open Line again.
Thank you, Dana. Hello, everyone. I think our session is really timely on several fronts. And some of you may have seen the CEO Confidence Index that's published quarterly by Visage International and was just released a couple of days ago. And the results for last quarter were really truly staggering, reflecting a 20% drop in confidence amongst senior executives in this year alone. And I think a lot of the discomfort is reflective of a more fundamental problem, which is that many entrepreneurs view their businesses as being tied to the economic cycle. And if you think about that premise for just a moment, if you think that your revenue growth is tied to the overall economy, I think that that suggests a couple of things, that either you're not growing your market share or your industry is not growing as a whole, or both. So I think what that data suggests to me is that there are a lot of CEOs out there that feel that their companies lack any true competitive advantage, and they feel that their businesses are being marginalized. So in our time today, what I was kind of hoping to do was to lead a conversation, and I hope you'll all participate, on how you can create some separation from the pack and create more value for your customers. But I think any discussion about value begins with a fundamental decision that I believe every entrepreneur needs to make. And that is, are you going to be the low-cost leader, or are you going to have the highly differentiated offer? And the reason that I would suggest that that's a choice is because the two have a completely different mindset about the world. One is a mindset about scarcity, and the other is a mindset of abundance. I once heard about a guy who had presented to a Walmart buyer who had lawn furniture set up as his office furniture. And he was really sending a message to every vendor that, you're going to do business with us, with the low-cost leader. I expect you to be taking costs out of our system every day. And this idea of scarcity is nothing new. It's something that really started during the industrial age with a manager. Oops, I just skipped a slide. with a management principle known as the experience curve. And the experience curve dictated that the more you produce of a thing, the greater the expectations on the part of your customers will be that your prices will continue to decline. But what I'd like to suggest to you is that even if you have the highly differentiated offer, you still carry a similar burden. And that burden is that over time, your customers will expect that you will expand your bundle of services. So let's see how the theory kind of played out in the downturn and since. And kind of in the height of the downturn, I did this analysis of U.S. restaurant chains, and this is what I found. First, I segmented them. And what I would suggest is that in every industry, there is a similar stratification, kind of high, medium, and low in terms of price and the relationship to quality and service. And what I did for these chains was I analyzed their net operating margins, which are the numbers on the right. So this is what I found. The white tablecloth restaurants, so that would be the Ruth Chris and the Mortons of the world, they had such high margins in the first place, they were able to eke out a 3 or 6% net. The themed casually specialty restaurants, like Cheesecake Factory, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, they were able to cut a 6 or 9% net. But if you look at the companies in the middle, Bennigan's and Steak and Ale, they skipped Chapter 11 and went straight to Chapter 7 because their business was so bad. And the companies remaining in that space, so that would be Applebee's, TGIF, Ruby Tuesdays, they're all cutting stores, and they're really, really suffering. Dana, do you have a thought on maybe why that might be true?
No.
Well, if you go into an Applebee's bar or you go into a TGIF's bar, I'm sure you'd agree that there is no differentiation whatsoever. They look exactly the same. Their menus are the same. Their servers even look the same. But the interesting dilemma is, I think for most marketers, is their instincts are, we should go to the biggest market. So this is the space where there are the most customers, but it's also the space where there is the most competition. And so what we're seeing in the restaurant business is those that have failed to differentiate are really struggling financially. Then the fast casual segment, so these are the healthier alternatives to fast, like Panera Bread. They're fairly differentiated. They've done well. And then, of course, McDonald's, this is no typo, folks, 27% net operating margin with a dollar menu. And Yum Brands, that's KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, their margins are strong as well. So, Dana, where is it that folks in this fast food, low-cost operator segment, how is it that they're able to maintain these types of margins?
Wow. Volume?
Right, scale. But I would suggest that there are few small or even mid-market companies that have enough volume to play in that sandbox very long with, you know, Fortune 100-type companies. So kind of the point of the slide is that you can make money as a low-cost operator, or you can make money probably if you're priced a little bit above premium, and you can sustain margin long-term in the ultra-premium category if you can make it through the downturns. But if you're priced in the middle, it creates a lot of problems because the customer doesn't know what to make of you. They don't know if you're the price offer or you're the service and quality offer. And we've seen the same exact thing happen in the department store industry. Walmart always does well. Nordstrom's always does well. But you may remember Montgomery Ward's and Mervyn's.
Right.
And Sears and Kmart always say their merger is like two guys who don't know how to swim grabbing for each other in the deep end. So the middle has really, really eroded in the department store industry. There's actually a phrase for it. We call it treasure hunting. And what's happening in business to consumer is that consumers are trading down on some goods so that they can afford to buy other luxury goods. You could sit on a Southwest flight, and the guy next to you might be wearing a Rolex watch. So why does a guy with a $10,000 watch strive to save $20 on an airfare? And it's because of this kind of treasure hunting mentality. So let's apply this to those of our participants on the line that are in B2B. So what we see is that there is a continuum of value, and people really have several purchase triggers when they're buying a good or a service. And I think the opportunity that we have in the call today is to discuss how you can secure higher prices and margin for the products and services that you sell. So a good example of this would be if you were a CPA, you're selling a functional product such as doing basic tax returns. Over the course of time, perhaps you develop a specialty, say doing trusts, and then you're selling something that is more of more specialized value. And then the highest form of value is emotional value. So that would be when they have a membership at an exclusive golf club and they're able to build a bond with customers that might be difficult to break. So the three purchase triggers are functional value, specialized value, and then emotional value. So let's see how this plays out in B2B. So there are goods. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm having a little trouble with these slides. Let's go back one. So there are all services that we procure that are pretty much a price buy. So I'll use workman's compensation, for example. We don't look for the value-added provider who can garner a lot of extra value-added services for us. We basically buy on price. And you'll notice those types of things are providing functional value. Then there are things by their very nature that we look to be mid-range. So I'm sure, Dana, you've worked with a lot of Fortune 100 HR kind of folks. They use salary bands where they try to assess what the value of a particular employee would be based on a range of competitive salaries in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And most companies, they want to stay within the 40th and 60th percentile. So by their very definition, they're mid-range. And then there are other things that we're willing to pay a premium for. So if you go to hire an intellectual capital attorney, that's going to cost you $400 an hour or more, which is about 25 times the minimum wage. So there are some things that we trade down for, some things we're mid-range for, and there are other things that we will trade up for. But I would suggest those are the things with either technical or emotional value. So here is kind of a, and I should have shared this caveat with you earlier. I'm going to share a lot of big branded B2C examples with you today. But I would suggest to you that the principles are exactly the same whether you're small or large and whether you're B2C or B2B. But here is a B2C example of trading up. So what the soda companies do is they hook us all on sugar when we're about 6 years old. And mom goes out and she buys a 2-liter bottle of soda that's around $2.19 or 3 cents an ounce at the bottom of the pyramid. And then if you were to go buy that same soft drink in a fast food establishment, you'd pay 5 cents an ounce. Out of a vending machine, it would be 8 cents an ounce. And the very same product in a white tablecloth restaurant, you'll pay about $3 for a Coke. That's 25 cents an ounce, which is nine times the acquisition cost. So what I think is fascinating about this slide is counter to the thinking of a lot of entrepreneurs that I've talked to is, what they tend to do is they tend to typecast their customers and say, our customers look like this, and they're willing to pay that. And what this data would suggest is that someone is willing to pay based on their particular circumstances at a particular moment in time.
That's interesting.
Sorry, I'm very mechanical here with the slide. So. I'm not here to suggest to you that because you're the low-cost leader that you won't try to differentiate or that if you were highly differentiated that there won't be times that you compete on price, because you certainly will. What I am saying is that there's a cadence of competition that we often see amongst competitors. And the cadence is that they start to look and act and smell the same. Their trade show booths look the same. The language of their salespeople is the same. There are just some industry norms that we need to try to break. So what I'd like to try to do with the remainder of our time today is talk about the differentiators that you can use to create kind of some separation from the pack and break the cadence of competition. So the first differentiator is emotional triggers. So my wife and I, we decided to go to a nonprofit event a couple of years ago, and I decided I was going to buy a new tuxedo. So I go into the department store, and I told the salesperson, you know, I really love that white dinner jacket look. He says, well, let's see how that looks. So he grabs one off the rack, and he throws it on my back, and he says to me, that is James Bond. And I thought to myself, never in the history of mankind had a transaction closed so fast, because I wanted to be James Bond. And, you know, had he selected three black jackets, I would have looked at the lining, I would have looked at the fit, and I would have gone through this very logical comparison about the jackets, and I probably would have selected one within a very narrow price range, maybe $30 or $50. But once he put the white jacket on my back and told me I was James Bond, price became really irrelevant to me. And I think there's some important implications to that for marketers. When I look at websites, just for example, what I see a lot of is, this is who we are. This is what we do. Our marketing can become very mechanical. And I think it's very, very important that you look at all your marketing collateral, that's web, that's print, and even the email blast that you send out. It might be an entry to a restaurant or a facility. And you make sure that your messaging connects with people on an emotional level, and it speaks to why they should do business with you. So because you, on your website, if you say we've been in business for 40 years and we manufacture fabrication equipment and we do this and that and the other thing, that still hasn't told me why I should do business with a particular supplier. So look for emotional triggers. And the other thing I just want to mention about marketing is it's very important you be concise, because we kind of live in an ADD world, and nobody has any time. So you really have to get to the point with your messaging. Just a couple other points real quickly on marketing. One is, we've seen the emergence in the last few years of defensive branding. So, for example, Coach, who manufactures very high-end ladies' handbags at $500 plus a pop, realized that if they're going to participate in the economy, that they were going to have a lower-cost alternative. So what they did was they came up with a new brand called Poppy, which is defensive in a way that they're not diluting their core brand, but they were still able to have a price offer. And kind of the opposite of that is comparison branding. So Avis has done this for years. You know, we try harder. They acknowledge they're number two. And so if you're number two or three or four in a space, sometimes it's actually beneficial to compare yourself to the market leader and then kind of show what your differences are and why it might be advantageous to do business with you. Service innovation is a great differentiator. And there's been a lot of attention for the iProducts, and with good reason, but what I think gets lost in the discussion sometimes is the magnitude of the service innovation that Apple has brought to us through things like the App Store and iTunes. And when you combine a product innovation like an iPad with a service innovation like the App Store, what you get is a combination where you provide a really unique customer experience. And I know the word experience is really overused, but let's think about the value of experiences for just a moment. When we were all kids and it was our birthday, Mom would go out and she'd buy the raw ingredients and she'd bake us a birthday cake. And we had low expectations. We'd have a few friends over, we'd sit around a dining room table, and we'd play some board games. So the cost of the product itself to bake the cake was about $4. Then we had the service economy of the 80s and 90s kind of evolve, and Mom could just go out now and she could buy a birthday cake at any grocery store for $10 or $12. Dana, do you know anyone with young kids?
Yep. Yeah,
what do you think their expectation is on their birthday today?
They want something fairly cool.
Yeah, they want to go to Chuck E. Cheese, or they're going to have a themed party, or they're going to go horseback riding or race cars or something. So a birthday party today sets parents back $500. So we've gone from $4 product to $10 service to $400 experience. Dana, what do you think you pay per pound for raw fish in a grocery store?
Oh, that's a good question. $6 to $7.
Yeah, probably more like $8 or $10.
Mm-hmm.
Grocer wants to add a little marinade, a little value add to the service. You might pay a couple dollars more.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think you pay per pound for sushi in a sushi restaurant?
Oh, you know, that's an interesting point. Never thought of it that way.
They give you an ounce at a time, so you have to multiply it by 16. So let's say it's $100. So the product is $8. With the value-added service, it's $10. But with the experience, it's $100.
Hmm.
So the quality of the fish might be very good in the sushi restaurant, but that's not what you're paying this extraordinary price premium for.
Right.
You're paying the price premium for, you know, the sensation of the chef yelling arigato and you're slamming back the sakis with your friends and so on. So we can never talk about experience enough. And one of the observations I'd have of entrepreneurs is they become very consumed with the widget that they're producing and maybe even the services that they're bundling with the widget, but they don't think enough at all about customer experiences. So one practical tool that I'd like to share with you is I think every business a couple of times a year should do a touch point audit. And what I mean by a touch point audit is that you should evaluate every single way that you touch a client. So that's web, email, phone system, et cetera, et cetera. And you should probably have someone do it who's not kind of invested daily in the business. And I'll tell you that I'm calling into my clients' phone systems every day, and, you know, I just want to slip my wrists. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, what are their clients going through? So point is, we can't ever talk about customer experience enough. Service bundle is a really good differentiator. And I love this ad that Lowe's had run a couple of years ago, and it was a father and son in the driveway, and the father said, "Son, you will never believe the deal that I cut with Lowe's. Not only will they deliver our washer and dryer, they will pick up the old ones for free." And then the truck pulls up, and they wheel off the appliances. They take the old ones back. The truck pulls away, and it says on the rear gate, "Free pickup with any delivery." But what I love what Lowe's had done, because they had extended the transaction, and they provided a service that Home Depot and others weren't providing. Now, going back to my earlier comment about the burden that you carry as a differentiated offer, at any point Home Depot could emulate this service bundle. So it just suggests that you need to continuously expand what those things look like. Another thing I love is creating a signature product or service. So, Dana, if you check into the DoubleTree Hotel, what do they give you?
Cookies.
What kind of cookies?
Chocolate chips.
What kind of chocolate chip?
Warm.
Warm chocolate chip.
Yeah.
They actually have a warmer behind every counter at the DoubleTree Hotel, and I actually plan my whole day to check in at about the right time, like around 3, to get my chocolate chip cookie. I'm amused that this, and it may be subliminal, but this $200 a day purchasing your decision that you're making is at least partially affected by something that costs 25 cents. But what's distinctive about a signature is it's something that you expect every single time. And I think businesses need to look for things that they can deliver that might be unique in some way. And the example I'm going to give you is about Christmas gifts, but the conversation is not about Christmas gifts. Okay. Now, I was talking to a CEO in Atlanta recently, and I asked if he had some kind of signature, and he said, "Well, what we do is every year we send out something completely outrageous for Christmas that people are not expecting." And he said that his goal was, when his present came in, that he wanted people huddling around the table to see what it might be. And well, last year what it was the components to make a gingerbread cake, gingerbread house. And then he had a Christmas or a holiday party, and he invited all his clients to come to present their gingerbread house, and then it was a contest. And, you know, I thought that was a very, very clever idea of just doing something to stir the pot. And, you know, I'm not suggesting any of the things that we're talking about today are going to get you a 15 or 20% margin bump. We're really talking about a hyper-competitive marketplace where these little nuanced things They may get you 2%, or they may win you the business, break the tie. And I think those kinds of things that create emotional attachment really go a long way. Dana, do we have any questions so far?
Actually, we had one. Maybe we'll talk about this a little later. What are some ways you've seen businesses improve their customer experience for both customers and clients?
Well, I think the wording of that is very interesting because it suggests great insight on whomever asked the question, that one thing you can do is not only to look to improve the experience of your clients, but to try in some way to improve the experience of your client's client or your client's customer. Another thing that I've seen is I had a client that they did a peer review. So my client's CFO went to meet with their customers' CFOs. And in one case that I heard about, they came to realize that their invoicing was very clumsy, and the customer was kind of irritated about it. Now, the CFO may not seem like a decision maker, but in fact, I think that they are. And today, our relationships need to go deep and wide with customers. So, you know, he might in some way be a champion for you within that company. And when my client resolved these invoicing issues, he started getting paid a lot faster.
Huh.
You know, so peer review would be one thing. Touch point audit would be another.
Interesting.
Okay. So moving on. Validation from a third party is a great differentiator. Lots of examples of this. ISO 9000, Project Management Institute. But my very favorite example is what the car companies do with certified pre-owned. So say you buy a Lexus, and it's certified pre-owned. They're really saying that because this car has passed this 100-point inspection, you should pay us a premium for it. They are certifying themselves. And I'm not advocating that companies do that. Perhaps they should use a third party. But the broader point I'm trying to make is that validation from a third party can be a very powerful differentiator unless all your competitors start to copy the same validation and what you need to go find something new. Exclusivity is a great differentiator. The slide's getting cut off. It's actually a photo of the Soup Nazi, which was many people's favorite Seinfeld episode. And if you remember, you know, Jerry and George and Elaine, they got in line, and the Soup Nazi kicked them out for a year because they didn't meet his rules and so on. And it's kind of an amusing clip, but what it reminds us of is we all want what we can't have. And I think that language is very important in our interactions with clients and with prospects. And one thing that I'm always talking to CEOs about is, first of all, how is it that they fire prospects who are only interested in price before they're ever hired as a vendor? And time and time again, they tell me the same thing, which is if they're in a situation where they're bidding on a project and the customer seems to be only interested in price and they walk away from that situation, very often those prospects come back to them and they're willing to pay much more because if they really do see the value in what you do, they'll come around. And if they don't and they're just a price buyer, you know, maybe you don't want them as a customer anyway. So that just requires, you know, a particular level of discipline. You know, also a lot of organizations are coming up against a lot of RFQs. And what I would suggest is, you know, if you're running against the request for proposals, that is really an attempt by the client to debundle you. And so I think that reinforces how important bundling is. That is a way that you can continue to improve your margins and charge higher prices. So when I say exclusivity is a differentiator, when you get in those situations where you are price competitive, there are things that you can do to take things away. So, for example, when we write a scope of work, we always use language like we work with an exclusive list of clients. That. And then in that, we really try to clarify who the ideal client is for us. And we're trying to send a message that you know, if you don't fit in this bucket, we might not be the right vendor for you. And that seems for some reason to entice people to want to do business with you more.
Mark, a question just came in. How do you, potential clients coming to you, how do you qualify them these days? Because let's say there is a request for information. Is it always best to respond, or is it better to qualify and see if it's real or not?
The companies that are great at RFQs, what they do is they're so close to the customer that they're either writing the spec or they have some kind of intelligence about it that gives them some kind of advantage. So they know, say, the weighting of the variables within the spec, or they have some information that everyone else doesn't have. If you're just filling out forms and mailing them in the blind, the chances of you winning the proposal are very slim. And if your salespeople are unable to provide you any more context, then it kind of speaks to their lack of intimacy with the client, in my opinion.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point. Does it cost money to put a proposal out?
Sure. Time is money.
Yeah.
So information is a great differentiator. A lot of discussion about cloud computing. And to me, cloud computing really is just a way to deliver information faster, cheaper, better. And there are entire business models out there predicated on who has the best information. For example, Marriott is the most profitable hospitality company because they have the highest utilization rate. They have figured out the magic of what price to charge on what room based on their utilization at that moment. Very similar thing with Harrah's, who's the most profitable gaming company. They have the best analytics in terms of what we spend in the casino, and they do the best job of extracting our money, you know, from us when we're in the casino. So I think as time goes on, what we're seeing is those who have the best information are going to have a really significant strategic advantage in the information age.
Hmm. So the prices in a Marriott vary then based on number of factors when you're walking in the door?
Yeah, if you book a room, say, 3 days before, let's say you book a Marriott room 3 days in advance,
mm-hmm.
that price is going to fluctuate based on the day of the week and the season and what their current capacity is.
Hmm.
And all the hotel chains do that. It's just that Marriott does a little bit better than the others.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay. Surprise is a great differentiator, and I think we have a lot to learn from that great management mind, Jerry Garcia. But this, you might find this fascinating. The Grateful Dead in the 60s had a board of directors, and they had a call center. And when people were going to concerts, they would actually extract their phone numbers. And the call center would call the Deadheads on the phone, and they'd tell them, you know, the Dead's going to be in San Francisco next weekend, they're going to be in San Jose the week after that. And the Deadheads did something very, very interesting. They followed them around, which you just wouldn't see today with a popular rock band. And the reason that they followed them around is because every show was very distinctive. No one ever knew what they were going to play because every show was a jam. And what I'd like to suggest is one of the mistakes that we routinely make as marketers is when we have a client and we're the incumbent, we can become very comfortable with them. We figure what's always worked will continue to work in the future. Now, compare that with the incentive of someone who's trying to take the business from you. Their behavior is very different. They're smothering the client with new offers and sports tickets and all kinds of things. And I actually believe that our clients get bored of us. I refer to it as customer fatigue. So it's very, very important that we continue to do things to break the fatigue. So I heard about a guy who was doing a business review with an existing client on an iPad, and he was thumbing through all the presentations, and at the very end of the presentation, he folded it up and he said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Customer," and he handed him the iPad. Now, I'm not advocating for kind of extravagant gifts because that doesn't play as well as it once did. But I think the point here is imagine the shock value of that meeting.
Huh.
It's a meeting that the client is never going to forget. So we need to find things like that to break the monotony with our current clients. Dana, do you have any questions before
I move on? That's pretty amazing. That is pretty amazing.
Customer feedback is another important differentiator. And for years, many of us have used Zagat for restaurants. We've used TripAdvisor for travel. And if you ask just about anyone under 30 how do they evaluate restaurants today, they all go to Yelp. And Yelp should, frankly, just scare the crap out of everyone on this phone call. Because in this example on the left, this isn't restaurants and this isn't hotels. It's financial institutions in San Francisco. And you'll notice that all of them have more than 20 ratings, which means that people are using the site. And I think what it speaks to is a world that is coming to us very, very shortly where all of our businesses, regardless of what industry you're in, will be rated in real time on the Internet by customers. And so there's a couple of ramifications to that. I think the first is we all need to know what our customers are thinking about us. And the second is we need to control the message on the Internet, because if you don't control the message on the Internet, someone will control it for you. So you really have to be proactive in this area. I'm also amused. The other example on here is of eBay. We all follow the same three-step process when we're buying something on eBay. First, we select the item. Then we rank it by price. And then the third thing we all do is look at the ratings of the seller. So in that case, customer feedback on the Internet is to validate a vendor you've already kind of pre-selected. So in either case, it's very, very important that the businesses be aware of the opinions of their customers.
How do you control that, Mark? Because let's say I've seen this for some businesses. There are a couple folks that become very vindictive. They get their friends to post things. Yet, you know, that's a pretty good business. How do you deal with that? Any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, you need to know that the comments are there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's a lot of businesses, they don't even know what's being said about them on the Internet. One thing every business owner should do, and I imagine most people on the line have done this already, is you enable Google Alerts.
Mm-hmm.
So Google Alerts, every once a day you get an email, and there's a listing of everything that's been said about a certain phrase. So you put in Lighthouse Consulting. Every mention of Lighthouse Consulting is emailed to you every day free of charge. But to the broader question, you know, that's probably something that you're hiring one of these defensive specialists for. But having a proactive strategy, being on the Internet, and making sure you're ensuring there are positive ratings to go along with the negative ratings, because people know. People intuitively know there are some wacky people out there posting some wacky things.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as there are enough positive comments, I think you can combat that. But that's certainly not my area of specialty.
Okay.
That's actually a typo. This should say speed is a great differentiator. And one thing, when FedEx burst on the scene, their tagline was, when it, remember, Dana?
Well, isn't that terrible? I should know.
Yeah, when it absolutely, positively has to get there overnight was the tagline.
Mm-hmm.
It was, in effect, a speed guarantee.
Mm.
When Domino's burst on the scene, they had a similar tag, which was 30 minutes or free. So speed is a great differentiator, and guarantees are a great differentiator, and combined they're even a better differentiator when you do a speed guarantee. Now, I'm not suggesting that people should just blindly go out and do guarantees. I have actually had a client who they sell refurbished computer systems to school systems, and you can imagine the objection that they face most often is people don't trust refurbished computers. So their competitors have a one-year guarantee. My client is offering a lifetime guarantee. because they know enough about their clients that they're so dysfunctional they don't even know where the computers are.
Yeah.
And what they've done is, you know, they carry a reserve on their balance sheet, and every year the true cost for their warranties are much less than 1% of sales. So I'm not saying blindly offer guarantees. I am saying perhaps you do some beta tests to see if there are any guarantees that will resonate with your market and with your customers.
Mm. Very clever.
Okay. So in the few minutes we have left, I want to talk about growth because that's a fascination to most entrepreneurs. And I would suggest there are several places where you can grow. And kind of to help you make that decision, I always like to ask this question. If you weren't already in this business, would you enter it today? It's a question that Peter Drucker asked of Jack Welch when he was at GE and really drove a lot of their behavior after that. And I challenge all of you on the line to give that some thought. If you weren't already in this business, would you enter it today? If the answer is yes, then that tells you you're kind of on plan. And if no, it kind of might govern the kind of diversification or what markets you might want to go into and the speed you might want to do that. But the first place that we should always think about growing is in adjacencies, in markets that are directly adjacent to the market we're already in. So Honda being a good example of that, when they grew, they grew from their core competency of producing efficient automobile engines into motorcycle, jet, and marine, and so on. The other thing we're seeing a lot today is a lot of vertical integration. So we read about the recent Google acquisition of Motorola would be a great example of that. Companies like Boeing are buying up their suppliers. Coke and Pepsi are buying up the bottlers. And the reason that people are looking for vertical integration is they want to participate in margin upstream and downstream. Sorry, that's a long slide on the screen. So, you know, if you're in a position where you're thinking about any potential acquisitions, you know, don't only look at horizontal acquisitions in the form of competitors, but also look potentially at companies that might improve your cost position in some way, such as vendors. And also know that your customers they're having the same conversations, and they may at some point come to you and look at you as an acquisition. In the slides. Okay. Growing into white spaces is probably the sexiest place where people want to grow. So the examples of that would be, for example, Cirque du Soleil. This is the popular example from the Blue Ocean Strategy. But one of the things that was fascinating to me was that during the height of the downturn, Wrigley came out with Orbit, which sells at triple the retail that Wrigley was selling for before.
Huh.
And I think that suggests that even when the economy is kind of sluggish, there is room for the super premium category. People just have to have kind of the courage to, you know, consider what are some of the markets that you might be able to infiltrate. Then kind of the final concept I want to share with you is I think this is an important time that you think about renegotiating your relationship with your customers. And let me tell you what I mean. During the height of a recession in the 90s, I was working in the food business. And one day, one of my regional managers told me that he'd landed a senior-level appointment with a decision maker for a national retailer, and he asked me to take the meeting with me. He asked me to take a meeting with him, and I did that. And in our meeting, I asked a lot of strategic questions over the course of about 45 minutes, and then I realized what the customer's fundamental business problem was. And it was that he didn't have the bandwidth, he didn't have the horses, the people to manage a category very well. So I asked him something of a provocative question back in those days, which was, what if I put someone in the office to manage it for you? And I'll never forget his response. His response was, do you mean you would do that for me? And I told him, yes, if I have every case and every store and every division 365 days out of the year, and I left that office with a multi-million dollar commitment, at which time I had the regional manager buy me a really big steak. But my point is that as times are somewhat sluggish as they are today, it's more and more important that the entrepreneur be out in the marketplace and talking to the customers and asking the strategic conversations because what's happening with salespeople is they're becoming more tactical and they're discounting very, very quickly and they're kind of losing their edge. And I think we need to kind of retrain them. So I have some questions on the screen you might consider in terms of the types of questions that you might ask, but I think every meeting kind of has to go through this logical progression where you warm up the client with some opening questions, then you ask some strategic questions, and then you try to transition the conversation to an anchor question where the client considers you as a possible scenario, possible solution to some of the problems that they're having. And in that example and in many other examples, I think one thing that is an opportunity is at any time you can offload any labor for the client and absorb that burden within your company, that puts you in the driver's seat as far as competitive advantage against like suppliers. So, you know, my closing thought is this. There's a struggle for value out there in the marketplace, and if you don't believe in the value of your company, no one else will. So it's very important that the entrepreneur also be the champion of value within their own organizations. And what I mean by that is if your salespeople are going to be fast to discount, then you have to be the one that has enough confidence in your product to say, you know what, we're good at what we do, and we're worth it. So your employees are really paying attention to how you show up right now, and I guess what I'm just trying to reinforce everyone on the line is you have to be a believer in your own product or service if you're going to continue to drive value. So we're out of time. Do we have any questions?
What we're going to do is I'm going to open up the line in just a minute. I've got to mention those questions, Mark, that you shared are phenomenal. And I would suggest everyone sitting down with your team and discussing those questions and adding to them, because those are just phenomenal. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you should always have a list of questions before you go in to sit with a client. And what a lot of salespeople don't get is if they're talking more than 20% of the meeting that they're losing. It's a lost art, and, you know, we have to get it back.
That's just phenomenal. In just a few minutes, we're going to conclude the program. I'm going to turn off the recording equipment. We're going to open up the line so you can talk to Mark. On your screen, you'll see registration for September 23rd open line. You can sign up for that and have your staff and others join us if they're available that day. Mark and I want to thank you so much for joining us and all the ideas that were shared. If you'd like to contact Mark to have further discussion on specifics about your industry, your team, or to have some one-to-one time together, or to discuss any of the ideas shared today, you'll see Mark's contact information on the screen in the lower left-hand side there. The information shared today is the property of Lighthouse Consulting Services, LLC, located in San Monica, California. Our mission statement is to bring effective insight to your organization. If you'd like more information on our services, please write me at dana@lighthouseconsulting.com. If you have other topics you'd like us to address, please let us know. We look forward to having you join us for our next Keeping on Track program. I want to wish you all a wonderful day. Hold the line. Let me turn the equipment off, and then we're going to open up the line.